the very existence of the non-Indian people in most of these non-13 colony states was predicated not upon warfare, but upon treaty agreements, and certainly in Minnesota, this land was not acquired by warfare. It is not a right of conquest. It's a right of pure contractual arrangements. You can call them treaties or anything you want. It was acquired by agreements, and Indian people have every right to say to the successors in interest that you have an obligation, just like when I buy a house or a piece of land. My title is based upon my successor in interest, and I can sue him if the title is defective, and I think the same thing is true. Indian people have every right to demand the successors in interest to all the resources, that they live up to the agreements with the successors in interest of the Indian people. It's a good, sound Anglo-Saxon legal concept that everybody in this country ought to understand.
This is the Northwoods American Indian Experience, a program series funded by the Minnesota Humanities Commission. You're listening to Kent Tupper, Chief Legal Counsel for the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe. We began our conversation on the banks of Onagum Marina, Leech Lake, Minnesota.
Hunting and fishing rights on Leech Lake Reservation and other reservations in Minnesota have been an issue for many, many years, since, I suppose, the coming of the white man to Minnesota. The Minnesota Supreme Court at various times has had hunting and fishing cases before it. In 1944, the Minnesota Supreme Court had made a ruling that a member of the Leech Lake Band had rights, hunting and fishing rights on trust land on the Leech Lake Reservation. Those issues that have come up more recent years had come up in those years. But I think probably what brought it to a head is that with the expansion of recreation time and more non-Indians coming into reservation areas and more development of resorts and the tourist industry in northern Minnesota, that these rights became more important to Indian people because there was more of a conflict with non-Indians over who had the right to regulate them and who had the right to use these resources. So it came down to be a kind of a conflict or clash over resources and regulation of resources. And to Indian people, of course, hunting and fishing is probably symbolic of a lot of things to them, and one of the things it's symbolic of is their rights to certain rights that they believe they'd preserved under treaties with the United States government, and rights that were very important to the continuation of their culture and their continuance as a distinct group of people with a government. Indians are not separated apart on the basis of race in this country like many other groups, and their rights are not founded upon race. They're founded upon their membership in political organizations that are known as tribes or bands or Indian nations. And this hunting and fishing issue is part of the self-government and self-regulation of Indian people, of their own resources by their own government. And it's because of this conflict that arose, because of the push of probably non-Indian interests and businesses into the area, that it became very important to Indian people. The lawsuit that was commenced in 1968 on behalf of the Leech Lake Band of Chippewas against the Commissioner of Natural Resources finally ended in a victory for Indian people, in the sense that the court upheld their right that they had retained hunting and fishing rights, that they were not subject to state jurisdiction and state control, and that ultimately led into an agreement as a settlement of continued litigation between the Leech Lake Band of Chippewas and the state of Minnesota. Now that settlement was ratified in a sense by the governor entering the agreement, and then it went to the state legislature for ratification through the passage of legislation. So in a sense, all aspects of state government got involved in this. We had the attorney general's staff, the federal court system, we had the executive branch through the governor of the state of Minnesota, and then we had the House and Senate of the state legislature ratifying the agreement. So it was truly a total governmental commitment or involvement in this issue by the state, and the state was well represented in all phases of this. But part of the agreement was to drop any further litigation. A settlement was proposed that to protect the interests of the non-Indians and the Indians, the best way this could be done is through an agreement. And the agreement was basically that though Indian people had the right to commercialize these resources, that would be a fishery as an example, to produce walleyes for commercial sale, that obviously was deemed a threat by non-Indians who were in the tourist industry and the resort business. The state was concerned about their continued existence, and the tribe or the reservation and the band was also concerned about these were valuable resources that they wanted to say and how they were utilized. So the settlement was proposed that the band would not commercially use the resource, but on the other hand, in consideration of not using their own resource, that they could receive compensation that could be used by them for economic development, for housing, for welfare programs that their own government provides for their own people. And a fee was added to the state fee that would compensate, as part of a contractual arrangement, the band for not exercising its rights. And it was felt that this non-commercialization would then protect the tourist industry and protect the resort owners, who would know that the sporting interest, the tourist interest, could count on the continued vitality of this resource. On the other hand, it also provided income for the reservation government to continue its governmental functions to provide services, housing, goods, welfare, what have you, for its own membership. So that's where the part of the settlement was, that they would also formalize a conservation code. And in this conservation code, there are prohibitions against commercial hunting and fishing, and regulation of the seasons and the limit and the take. And there is a conservation court with a judge, and there are conservation officers that, in effect, act in many of the same ways as state conservation officers do. And this is what brought upon this system that exists today, is it's self-government, but it's in response to attempts by the tribe and band to work out agreements of mutual concern with the state and local units of government. And we think it's worked well. This is an issue that's an issue all over the country, and it's more emotional in areas where there are more non-Indians. A reservation that's totally isolated, as these reservations in northern Minnesota were at one time, don't have it as an issue. But the more the non-Indian people move into the area because of retirement or development of the area, the more it becomes an issue. And it's an issue in other reservations in this state, but it's a significant issue in other parts of the country, specifically in the state of Washington, where the right to take salmon is very important, both to the commercial salmon fishermen and to the Indian people who have traditionally relied upon the salmon as a form of way of life and sustenance form. So we have a very large commercial operation, the salmon industry, competing with Indians over who's going to take these salmon and who's going to sell them. And it's a very emotional issue out in that state. It's generated a lot of litigation and proposed laws and emotional response by everyone. The interests of the tribal government and Indian people and non-Indians aren't always opposed to each other. And I think the problem should be that a lot more non-Indians should understand that many times the interests of the tribe and the Indian people is exactly the same their interests are. That they want many of the same things and face many of the same problems, and that's good quality life in their area, and they also face a lack of services in their area. The non-Indians do, as well as the Indian people. And in many cases, in our view and the view of a lot of tribal government is better prepared and better qualified to understand the problems and deliver services than even many non-Indian governments are, because of the isolation of reservation areas. And I think it's true that many non-Indians who live on or near reservations have received benefits, and many still do receive economic benefits. The more vital and economically developed a reservation is, and the better economically Indian people are doing, it benefits the whole area. The money that's brought in programs and businesses run by tribal governments benefits everybody, because the money stays in the area and is expended in the area. I think the Federal Reserve System has estimated that a dollar turns over 5 times in an area before it leaves. So if a reservation or a tribe has a $1 million program, that's in a sense $5 million coming into the area, and that money is spent in the area. It goes to the local grocery stores, the local gas stations. Indian people utilize the same power systems and telephone systems, and it is good for everybody. And I think it's been difficult for a lot of people, because of the emotional issues, to truly appreciate the fact that Indians and non-Indians are not natural enemies in the sense of fighting or having to fight for these resources. The real problem gets down, in my view, to who is going to regulate these resources. And that's the real battle, is between tribal government and local county governments and state government, who want to fill up those vacuums that are created and to be the form of government that's going to regulate resources, be it hunting and fishing or zoning of land or issuing a building and sewage permits or those things that governments do. And I think the non-Indian basically still doesn't understand that Indian people have governments, and they don't understand the form of government, that it's elected and it is not the old traditional form, and that the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe is an example, and the Leech Lake Band all have subdivisions. They have a health division, they have education divisions of their government. They have qualified college-educated members performing jobs. They have technicians getting people into pollution control. All the things that state and county government do, they're developing very rapidly now as they're developing their government to meet the challenges of new changes in technology and overpopulation. It's probably going to be very important for the non-Indians to become aware of this and made more aware of what tribal government really is. Too many people think in the old stereotypes of the 17th century that that's what tribal government is today. And when people don't understand what the other form of government or what other people are about, they become concerned, frightened, and worried about what's going to happen to them in their future. And as an example, today there's a organization nationally and as well as close to the White Earth Reservation that feels that Indian people should be treated just like every other citizen, when that is not the issue. Indian people are citizens, but they are also members of a political group called a tribe or a band that have a distinct political and historical relationship with the United States government. And too many people have confused racial membership with governmental membership, and that I think creates to a great deal of the fears and suspicions that somehow Indian people are being treated differently and better, when in fact they are treated differently because of their historical relationship. They are not immigrants to this country and are not being treated as racial groups, but as political groups that have distinct forms of government and rights that no other group in this country has because of the constitutional basis of these relationships. It's something that's probably not taught in school, and people just don't understand it. And until people do come to understand it, it's going to be difficult for them to understand why Indian people make demands, be it for words that are called sovereignty or treaty rights. They were so important, and the word of the United States government was given through these agreements. In fact, the United States basically was created out of these agreements, certainly the United States west of the 13 colonies. And to say now that Indian people, after they've surrendered the majority of the land in the country through agreements that they lived up to, that now that the United States should no longer live up to its end, is of course a source of friction and a great deal of hostility that's generated on both sides. But if people understood the basis of these rights and understood the historical background of it, I think it would be much easier for them to understand what the issues are today. And in my view, that's the Indian people want a continued existence within this country as a distinct political entity. And those are called tribes, and they're all different. They have a different history and culture, and many of them have different languages. And they have different relationships with the United States government, and they do not want to surrender these rights that they preserved. And we don't think they should. There's any reason that they should surrender. I mean, it's not inconsistent with being an American citizen, in our view, or the existence of this country. Probably even today, other ethnic groups are taking more pride in their background and history, and the theory that you can't be different is kind of disappearing in this country. The old melting pot that everybody had to look and talk and act like each other. I think we're all becoming aware that cultural diversity is good for the country, and it makes it a better place to live.
So you see you see economics as the great equalizer here.
I think in our country, in our history, is I really think that money is equates with power, and those two things equate with how people deal with each other in this country. And I think my own view is I think that when people can get control of resources, money, and power, that they can all, you know, do much better in life. And I think the myth is that somehow we can do things for people by merely raising things to a moral issue. And I think we'd all like to be idealistic enough to think that if we say something's morally right, that people will all fall in line and go along with it. But I don't think that history has ever shown that to be true, in my view. I think it's once you get power and once you get the resources, and that equates to money, you get a lot of things done in this country. And I'm not saying that that's all bad. That's just the way it is that if you have the wherewithal to hire the people that you need to do things for you, be it lobbying or go to court or to perform services for you, you are just much more efficient, be it a business or a government or whatever it is, that you get things done that you want done. It's General Motors, Reserve Mining, when they deal with the state and federal government, are very successful in resisting things they don't want to do because they've got the resources to resist it. The federal government can break down most people that it wants to because it can litigate, it can legislate, and very few individuals or corporations have the resources to resist a prolonged exposure to a concerted effort by the United States government to make them change or to do things. Now, maybe the old classic example, it took them about 30 years to make the DuPonts divest themselves of their GM stock. Sometimes you look at how long Reserve Mining has been fighting their battle with the state and federal government, and you see that some corporations apparently are able to successfully chime, and sometimes they wear out the U.S. Attorney and the Justice Department.
Where are the magnitudes of scale? You had mentioned convincingly earlier that there are reservation people, maybe not in this state, but elsewhere, that are going to be unable to withstand the impacts of wealth, power, corporate economic concerns that want specifically, let's say, their land or natural resources. Doesn't that argument cut a little bit too much both ways in the against the interests of Indian people who are not potent enough?
Well, I think that in effect is true, that there are groups of people in this country, be it small tribes or bands of Indian people, that are probably, their continued existence is going to depend upon the moral issues, because they can't economically defend themselves. Whereas some of the larger tribes with resources probably can success and will successfully ensure their existence. And some of the small tribes and bands are so poor and with such small numbers that they are really existing at the caprice and whim, if you want to use those terms, of the United States government, who could at some future time reverse its present policies and decide that total assimilation or termination of their trust status was the answer to what maybe somebody in Congress thinks is the Indian problem. And of course, the real problem is Congress is not an ongoing individual. What I'm talking about, there's not a 200-year-old guy there that's been making all these laws as we change Congress every 2 years. And in the House and the Senate, every 6 years, everybody's been up for election. So we've got new people that don't know what the other Congresses have done. They don't have the experience of having heard testimony that were in old bills and old acts. And they have to be re-educated every Congress as to what Indian people are, what their rights are, what tribes are, and what governments are. And it's that's the constant danger to Indian people, is that every 2 years another Congress may come in, and with a lot of new congressmen who may say, oh, this is a problem, we got to resolve it. Instead of saying it's an ongoing relationship that's historically part of our country and will continue as long as we have a country, we have too many people jump in and say there's an Indian problem, and let's solve it. You know, like it's something that should be solved by doing away with it. When that is probably the wrong framework. It's not that there will never be problems, because there are problems between the state and federal government. Nobody's suggesting we abolish the government, you know. States and federal government fight over jurisdiction all the time. The state of Mississippi tries to tax liquor coming onto a federal military reservation, and that's governmental control. Who has jurisdiction? Who has power? The federal government says you pass a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit law, we're not going to give you money for your highways, or you enforce this Beautification Act, or we're going to cut off your highway funds. You integrate your schools, we're going to cut off your education funds. So those battles go on all the time, and nobody suggests that we got to solve the, you know, the state problem by abolishing states. You know, and that's the best way I can equate it, that that's what the problem is. Tribes exist. There will always be conflicts over jurisdiction and government, and that's natural. It's part of the system, and it's not a bad thing. And it shouldn't be viewed that way. It's just the nature of government. And when that comes up, instead of trying to abolish tribes, sometimes it requires compromise. It requires some redefinitions because these are ongoing changing situations. And they aren't static.
Let me take you back briefly to this moral turf. There are more Indians in the United States statistically, I believe, now than there were at any time in history, despite the fact that they were almost exterminated around the turn of the century. Where is the moral imperative? Where is the moral turf upon which Indian people can understand their relationship to the dominant society?
The dominant society is so ill-informed about Indian people and what their relationship is that it's extremely difficult for Indian people to verbalize themselves what the moral obligation is. And too often non-Indians say they're tired of being hit with guilt feelings about what their grandfathers or great-grandfathers did. Or many say, my great-grandfather or great-great-grandfather didn't even live in this country. I'm an immigrant. I'm a second-generation American. How can you put any moral obligation or guilt feelings upon me? I was the son of an immigrant, or my father's an immigrant. I came here. I was offered land. I homesteaded. The sins of past governments 200 years ago or 100 years ago are not my sins, and why should I feel any moral obligation or guilt? And I think they say that also about, you know, guilt towards black people. I didn't have slaves. My father didn't have them. Why should I have any sense of obligation or moral feelings towards them? However, it seems to me the obligation Indian people can talk about is that they're all part of the same government, and it is our ongoing government that maintains the moral obligations of its predecessors, that the government is an ongoing government. It hasn't ended. And the mere fact that these aren't the same people in Congress today that were there 100 years ago that passed many laws that have affected people or ratified treaties doesn't change the moral obligation of our ongoing government to fulfill the commitments, because in fact you are elected to the same government and you have the obligation of fulfilling it. And we all, non-Indians, receive the benefits that were derived by an earlier government that acquired land and resources. As I said, the very existence of the non-Indian people in most of these non-13 colony states was predicated not upon warfare, but upon treaty agreements. And certainly in Minnesota, this land was not acquired by warfare. It is not a right of conquest. It's a right of pure contractual arrangements. You can call them treaties or anything you want. It was acquired by agreements, and Indian people have every right to say to the successors in interest that you have an obligation, just like when I buy a house or a piece of land. My title is based upon my successor in interest, and I can sue him if the title is defective, and I think the same thing is true. Indian people have every right to demand the successors in interest to all the resources, that they live up to the agreements with the successors in interest of the Indian people. And it's a good, sound Anglo-Saxon legal concept that everybody in this country ought to understand, because it is, in fact, the basis of our contract law and our land law and everything else. Yeah. It's just that the thing that disconcerts me the most is somebody who's grown up and gone through the school systems in states such as Minnesota, that it's virtually not covered and never has been in our educational system, and it's no wonder that the average citizen doesn't understand it. They're still dealing in stereotypes and B-class Western movie understanding of Indians, and it's totally wrong. It was erroneous. It depicts something that never probably existed. Much of the view of American Indians is based upon about a 30-year period of history of Plains Indians, and has nothing to do with most of the other Indians in the country. It's a very small segment of Indian people that are even depicted. Whether they were even depicted correctly or not, who knows?
How would you, in your own experience in dealing with Indian people as their legal representative over years, account for, explain the incredible patience, lack of hostility, and still trust that seems to pervade the community.
I think it's probably a cultural attribute of Indian people, something that maybe a lot of other cultures could emulate or at least look at, how any group of people can have the faith that they've had, that they can exist and survive, and how they have managed to survive, I think is a great story. Because it isn't just the Western tribes that have survived. The Eastern tribes and the original colonies still exist. There are tribes in the Eastern United States that have been ignored by the press and the movies and the newspapers for years and years that still exist in their traditional areas. They still speak their native language, practice their native religions, and have preserved their families and identities and much of their culture. Culture is ongoing and changes, but they still have preserved many of their old values and accommodated them with the changes in technology. I mean, when you think about that, that's astounding that 350 years or better and 200 years plus under the United States government, these people have maintained governments, beliefs, traditions, and they must certainly believe in them, because if they weren't good values, they would have abandoned them. And one of the good values is, I think, is patience and a belief that they can survive and will survive. I think that that's a good message for everybody. That I think there's also another factor, is that I think Indian people are very realistic people. They understand that population-wise that they are just a small percentage, and that they cannot survive by taking some hostile, aggressive action in today's world that would destroy them. They tried certainly to protect their homeland against an invasion by Europeans, and they found it didn't work. They were almost annihilated. And interesting enough, I find that Indian people over the years have expressed a belief that their populations historically have been much bigger than apparently we like to acknowledge in our schools and systems, that somehow there are more Indians now than there ever have been. Is maybe not true. There's some evidence that Indians may have been a much greater population, but the genocide would be something very unpleasant for us to acknowledge in our history books. The large numbers of Indian people that may have been killed by Europeans, and I don't mean just by the United States and these plains warfare, but since the Spaniards and the English and the French appeared here, that the population of North and South America may have been significantly larger than it is now. And nobody would find it pleasant to admit that what happened to all the people. But I think it's also true that there have been non-Indians who have been sympathetic and friendly to Indian people, and I don't think Indians have ignored that. There are many tribes all over the country who employ non-Indians in their programs and provide benefits to them. And there's been, obviously, intermarriage over the years. And I don't think that there's some blanket animosity towards white people by Indians. And I think that's always historically been true, that Indians have been much more ready to accept white people as individuals. And where they may not like the United States government policies or state policies, they still accept people on their basis of what they are as a human being. And that's an admirable trait in the face of the adversity that they've faced over the years. But I think I've found that true, that there are very few places that where I've done work for tribes that I've not found that they would accept white people that were sincere and honest and wanted to deal with them. They wanted to deal with them. And as I say, they may reject a policy of the government, but they aren't rejecting the rest of the country. And that's very realistic. I suppose you emotionally would have a very hard time surviving if you had to live in blind hatred or just hatred in response to what had been done to you. You would be, I suppose, emotionally crippled, and you couldn't go on and develop. And I think Indian people, given the opportunity, will develop their tribes and their self-government. They were crippled seriously by the United States government through legislation in the late 1800s, and it was intended to break down their tribes. The Allotment Acts is an example. And they're trying to overcome many of the things that were intentionally done to them to help destroy them. And they're going onward into new, more viable forms of government. And as we mentioned before, they aren't locked into some 17th century stereotypes. They're not riding horses around the plains chasing the buffalo anymore. And they're forming forms of government to meet their present needs. And I think that given the opportunity, they will develop those governments like everybody else does. And I think, given all the difficulties that they've faced, I think they're doing a remarkably good job. Not that there aren't failures, as there are failures with everybody.
Kent Tupper, Chief Counsel for the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe, has provided an overview for the series entitled The Northwoods American Indian Experience.